You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Friday the 26th of November 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Well, I do apologise that Grandpa Dan is not here with me today. It's Thanksgiving over there in America, so happy Thanksgiving to all our American listeners. And Grandpa has taken a few days off to celebrate with his family. But of course, we do still have news to be getting into today, and Hope Not Hate have released a report on Patriotic Alternative. It's called Patriotic Alternative, Britain's Fascist Threat. Don't worry, I'm not going to bore you by going all the way through it. It is, as usual, it's filled with untruths, lies, slurs. I'll just point one in particular out. They refer to me as foul-mouthed, and I can't even recall the last time that I swore. I certainly don't swear in public here on Radio Albion. I don't swear in private either. And I think most people are aware that I'm not the sort of person that has a foul mouth. So by alleging that I do, they really show themselves up as not telling the truth. In actual fact, telling the opposite of the truth. And people often say, well, I Hope Not Hate have been caught out so many times not telling the truth. Why is it that the mainstream media go to them? Why do they treat them as if they are an authoritative source when it's so easy to prove that what they say is wrong? And the reason for that is because of the National Union of Journalists guidelines. All the mainstream media journalists, they're all signed up to the National Union. And they have guidelines for this, and you can look this up, and it comes under reporting racist organisations, of course, because they won't call us nationalists, they won't call us patriots, they'll just designate anybody that does not support the establishment narrative as being racist or far right. So they have these guidelines for reporting on racist organisations. They say you do not have to report on racist organisations. So they're implying there that if left wingers have designated somebody as being a racist, then you should just try not to report on them. Number two, as with any interviewees, check the claims made by representatives of such organisations. And then it says, and seek opposing comments. So they're basically supposed to look through anything that we've said and see if they can find anything that opposes it, and only report on claims that have been made by the organisation if they can find some opposing comments to put with it. Number three, they say seek to broadcast or publish information exposing the myths of racist organisations. And of course, they don't mean myth in a positive sense there. They mean myths as in lies, as if nationalist organisations, of course, who they're designating as being racist here, as if nationalist organisations tell lies. Well, they're not going to be able to find many, are they? Because our views are based on facts and statistics. They say if a racist party has been elected to local government or the European Parliament, rules around party election broadcasts do not necessarily mean you have to cover them. See the Ofcom regulations for more detail. So try and find any excuse you can not to cover parties or groups that are popular, if they're not left-wing. And finally, they say, if you feel uncomfortable about covering racist parties, get advice from your union. Make sure you research the background of racist organisations and their members. For example, see Searchlight, UAF, Reporting the Far Right, and Hope Not Hate. And if you look further into this, they will say that Hope Not Hate are the authoritative source that journalists should be going to. So in order for these journalists to do their research, in order for them to comply with the guidelines of their union, they have to report on what Hope Not Hate say. They have to take what Hope Not Hate say as gospel. So even when Hope Not Hate are quite clearly not telling the truth, the journalists have to report it anyway. They have to report Hope Not Hate's version, even when it conflicts entirely with what the truth is. So, I don't really see how anybody can look at that and not think, well, that is suspicious, isn't it? That this organisation cannot be looked upon critically in any way. And when you actually look at the title that they actually give themselves, they call themselves Hope Not Hate Charitable Trust. Well, they're not charitable in any way. They don't give anyone the benefit of the doubt. And you cannot trust the word they say. I think a lot of it is because they rely on informers and they pay informers. And informers can pretty much just make anything up, can't they? Because they know that nothing's going to get checked. And they know that nobody's going to hold Hope Not Hate to account if they're not telling the truth. They just get looked upon as if it's gospel. It's incredible. The more lies they tell, the more they will get caught out, I think. Anyway, I suspect that Patriotic Alternative will be talking about this in the PA monthly update, which will be on Radio Albion later. We have Mark Collette and Laura Towler letting us in on what PA have been up to over the last month. Getting into national news here. This week we had a tragedy in the Channel. A large number of illegal migrants ended up drowning. And this has been a big scandal. And of course, the left have been shrieking that this is because we don't have safe routes for asylum seekers into Britain. And Boris Johnson must open up safe routes across the Channel for people seeking asylum. And this is just not true. We do have safe routes for asylum seekers. The people that are trying to come across the Channel don't want to go through those routes. That's why they're illegal immigrants. Britain does take people from Syria, from Afghanistan, and they go to the camps there. And if people have a valid asylum claim, they are actually brought into the country. So it's not right when the left say we don't have safe asylum routes. We do. These people that are trying to come across the Channel, they don't want to use the safe asylum route for whatever reason, usually because they don't actually have a valid asylum claim. But there's a journalist at the Daily Mail, David Barrett, and he's been looking into the reasons why these people want to come to Britain. We're told they just want a better life. But, of course, well, why can't they build a better life for themselves in their own country? Why do they have to come and take somebody else's better life? Of course, the fault for them thinking in that way lies with our government for pretty much inviting them over here. It's quite clear that the West are inviting these people over here. That's the way that they see it. Recently, there were interviews that were carried out by RT of the people that were on the Belarus-Poland border, and they were asking them, why is it they want to go to Germany? And they said, well, because Germany loves us. Germany loves migrants. We've been told if we go there, we'll get houses, we'll get benefits, we'll get education. Angela Merkel has said that Germany can do this, and they love us over there. They really do. And if you look at the pictures, you've got all these white women holding up refugees, welcome, and clapping them and applauding as they're walking through the train station as if they're rock stars. So that's the way that they see this. And we only have ourselves to blame for portraying this image to them, that we want them to come over here. And it's the same in Britain. If you think back where I think it was about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, and there was a group of these illegal immigrants that were being sent back on a plane, and all the white passengers on the plane refused to allow the plane to leave unless they took the criminals off the plane and didn't deport them. I think in that case, it was actual criminals, because there was one very unfortunate young white lady who had been raped by one of these criminals, and she was shocked to see that he wasn't actually being deported, because all the white people on the plane refuse to let the plane go. So these would-be migrants, they see this in their home countries and they think, well, this is great. Europe is desperate for us. Europe really wants us to come over there. They keep telling their people that diversity is a strength and multiculturalism is great. So we want to go over there. And that's the reason why they come. And then they look into it and they say, well, this can't be true. Surely they don't give you houses and accommodation and food. And then they find out, well, yes, it is true. So this is the magnet. And all that we're being told today on the news is that Boris Johnson has had some stern words with the French and is saying that the French police have to up their game and they have to prevent these boats from making the crossing. Police really shouldn't have anything to do with it. It's if they knew that if as soon as they set foot in Britain, they would be put into a holding camp somewhere else, then they wouldn't come. And we know that this is exactly what would happen because it's what happened in Australia when they set up holding camps for them in Papua New Guinea. It reduced the number of people trying to break into Australia to zero. And it has to be looked at like that. It has to be looked at as if it's somebody trying to break into your home. They're trying to break into our country. And we want to deter them from doing that. It's much better to prevent them from sitting out in the first place than have this big magnet to them, this big reward that they're expecting once they get here, that the French police then have to devote lots of man hours to trying to prevent people from coming across. But the details of it are really quite scandalous when you look into them, as this journalist has done. He says, the horrific disaster in the Channel has raised stark and difficult questions about why migrants are so desperate to reach Britain. Almost 26,000 are known to have made the hugely dangerous journey so far this year, although the true number may be higher. But just days before this week's tragedy, a startling statistic had emerged. Junior Minister Tom Pursglove was asked by Home Affairs Committee Chairman Yvette Cooper how many of these thousands of people had been returned to the continent this year. 5, came Mr. Pursglove's revealingly meek reply. So this is the reason why they're coming. They know that they're not going to get sent back, are they? 5 people have been sent back out of 26,000. That have been known to come here this year. Priti Patel, I've lost count of the number of times that she says she's going to get a hold of this and she's going to prevent this. There was even a cartoon in a mainstream newspaper the other day with just a repeated picture of her saying she was going to put a stop to this, and she hasn't. I mean, we first started covering this invasion, which is what it is, because it's illegal immigrants turning up on our beaches, on the shores of our beaches. We first started covering this a couple of years back. And I think Sajid Javid was the Home Secretary at the time, and he said, we're going to get Border Force to put a stop to this. We're going to get the Border Force boats to come over from the Mediterranean. They're not doing anything there. And he brought 2 boats over, and what the 2 boats did was aid in picking these people up and then ferrying them to the shores of Britain. And then Priti Patel took over. She said, we're going to stop all of this. And she hasn't managed to stop any of it. All she's done is give money to the French and blame the French for this, and the French blame the British for this. And the real blame for this lies in us not stopping these incentives. We have to prevent these incentives. If they knew that they were just going to get taken to a holding camp in Africa while their asylum claims were processed, they wouldn't try to break in. He says here, the truth is once an asylum seeker reaches British soil, they are unlikely to leave, whether or not their claim is genuine. And that is just one reason why so many risk their lives to reach here. And that's the other thing you've got to think about. I mean, they really are risking their lives. I think 27 of them died this week of drowning. So they're that desperate to get to Britain. The prize in Britain is so great for them, the difference between the standard of living here that we managed to create for ourselves and the standard of living in Africa that they managed to create for themselves, that difference is so great that people are willing to risk dying to get it. I mean, it must be like hitting the jackpot for them to get to Britain. Some migrants enter Britain undetected, landing vessels and rushing up the shore before the authorities can stop them, and then they disappear into the country. There are, of course, no official figures on how many of these clandestines make it here. And of course, that's the other thing you've got to think about. The 26,000 number that we're given, that's just the ones that we know about. A lot of these people have friends and family that are already here, and they know that if they can get onto the shore and they can get to where their friends and family are, that they will be found work on the black market, and they can just disappear. I mean, it could be that it's twice the number, maybe four times the number, maybe it's 100,000 that have actually made it this year. We just don't know. Migrants encountered at sea by British authorities are handed life jackets and foil blankets for warmth and are then brought ashore, usually to the Home Office's processing centre at Tug Haven in the port of Dover. Here they are given clothing and hot food, sometimes surprisingly expensive. This month it emerged the Home Office had ordered 3,000 chicken shish kebab meals costing £19.50 each from a Kent chain of takeaways, plus hundreds of Domino's pizzas to feed the arrivals. At Tug Haven, initial details are taken from the new arrivals, who then undergo welfare checks and are sorted into families or single people, mostly men. They then travel by coach to hotels around Britain. I mean, it's just like going on holiday, isn't it? You get taken to a hotel once you get here, you get all checked over, you get your tourism guide in the coach that drives you to the hotel. They're even protected at these hotels as well. It's like a gated community for them, like when white people go to the Caribbean and they stay in a hotel there. And you can compare this. All these things that are handed over and given to them, life jackets, foil blankets, takeaways, and you can compare that to what Poland does. They get the old water cannon treatment, and there isn't one of them that's managed to break into Poland. Mobile phones, paid for by the taxpayer, are then distributed so the Home Office can keep in touch with the migrants. Pressure group Migration Watch UK, which campaigns for tougher border controls, says 14,000 of these handsets were given out between January and September this year. And I guess for the other 12,000, I should imagine they already had their own smartphones. They didn't need to be given one by the Home Office. I mean, there are a lot of people in Britain that don't have smartphones. There are elderly people that don't have smartphones. And yet people that have broken into the country, the equivalent of a burglar breaking into your house, is being given one. And it really is like a burglar breaking into your house, and the owner of the house says, "Would you like something to eat? Here you are, have a free phone. Use my master bedroom and stay there. And I will wait on you as if I am the hotel staff." Migrants also receive £39.63 a week from the Home Office to pay for essentials. And you might look at that and you might think, well, £39.63 a week, that's not very much, is it? That would be difficult to live on within Britain. But that's 2 weeks' wages in Somalia. If you look at the wages that they get in Somalia, at one of their lowest paying jobs, it's £80 a month. So £40 a week, just handed out from the Home Office, that's worth 2 weeks' wages in Somalia. And don't forget, these people are getting all their meals paid for and their accommodation. They're staying at the hotel. I mean, this is why this is such a huge magnet to these people. Those caring for babies and infants are given extra sums on top for food, and expectant mothers can apply for a one-off £300 payment. And of course, these people, that they haven't paid anything into the system. I mean, you rarely hear about that either, but the benefit system is supposed to be there for the people that have actually paid into it with their national insurance and their tax. And this is just a free-for-all for these people. And you're not going to get the best of them either, because the best of them, the nationalists among them, will be staying in their own countries and trying to build up their own countries and do their best for their people. The ones that are coming over to Britain are going to be the ones that don't have very much loyalty to their people and are just out for themselves and are just out for individualism and to make as much as they possibly can. I mean, possibly to send some back in remittances to other members of their family, but it's certainly not going to be the nationalist types that come into Europe. And it's also going to be the criminal types, because they're claiming asylum. I mean, they're basically saying, either they're saying we are fleeing war, or they're saying we are fleeing the authorities. And if they're fleeing the authorities, it's because they've broken the law in their own country. And yes, there are laws in some of these countries that are different to the laws that we have in Britain. I mean, in Africa, homosexuality is still illegal in a lot of places. So they can claim, oh, well, I'm homosexual and I've got AIDS, so I need to be looked after in Britain. And then we have a massive bill for all the medication as well. I mean, the whole thought about this asylum system, it's really for the countries that are surrounding you. And really, our asylum system should be there for the French if there was war in France, and there isn't any war in France, or if there was war elsewhere in Germany. When we had World War II, we took in refugees from Germany. We took in refugees from other places in Europe. We certainly didn't take in refugees from Japan or Singapore or India or Africa or any of these countries that are outside of Europe. I mean, maybe a way to solve this would be to say, well, we should only be taking refugees from Europe. But that's actually built into the system anyway, because you're supposed to claim asylum in the first safe country that you come to. The first safe country for most of these people that are coming is going to be a country in Africa, or it's going to be Turkey or somewhere in the Middle East. They're not interested in that, because in Turkey and the Middle East and in Africa, they don't get the equivalent of 2 weeks' wages in Somalia, do they? Hotels have become the main form of accommodation for migrant arrivals since the crisis exploded last year. Taxpayers are funding multi-million pound bills for thousands of rooms in 3- and 4-star accommodation on full board. And a lot of people can't afford to go on holiday and stay in 4-star accommodation. Anyway, most people end up having to stay in 3-star. And yet these people that have broken into our country, that they're rewarded with 4-star accommodation. Conditions are far cozier than those in mainland Europe. Greece, for example, opened a massive EU-funded asylum processing centre, which resembles a prison, on the island of Samos in the summer. The huge cost of accommodation has contributed to a huge rise in the asylum bill, which rocketed to almost £1.4 billion in the year to March, up 42% year on year. £1.4 billion being paid out to people that have broken into our home. Most migrants stay in hotels for months as their claims are processed. Here, some stand accused, including by Home Secretary Priti Patel, of gaming the system. You don't say. All of them are gaming the system, because there is no war in France. Before migrants even leave France, people traffickers brief them to emphasise aspects that could make their case stronger, and even to destroy their passports. Some claimants lie. Case files show asylum seekers have told untruths about their nationality, religion, background, sexuality, and age, all in an attempt to strengthen their claims. And that's because they're not actually fleeing war, are they? Their goal is just to get into Britain and get a better life for themselves. Some asylum seekers who are clearly adults have claimed to be under 18 and have been taught in secondary schools alongside British teenagers. And there have been reports that have shown that up to 85% of those claiming to be under 18 have actually been over 18. There was a study that was done in France. There was a report in Sweden where a dentist blew the whistle on this, and he said, all these people that have been brought to me that are supposedly under 18, they're all over 18. 85% of them are over 18. And he lost his job because they said that it was against the migrants' human rights for him to reveal their age. It was private medical information. He's actually being sued by the dentist. But what he said was also confirmed by a study that was done in France. And over here, we've had individual cases where there was an Iranian guy that was about 40 years old, this male that was in a classroom with 15-year-old British schoolgirls, and they were complaining about this. So there have been some quite high-profile incidences of this. Legal advice from migrant charities or legal aid-funded lawyers also helps claimants to make the best case. There are a lot of British citizens that can't get legal aid to help them, and yet these people that have broken into our home, they get it. Last week, Miss Patel said the suicide bomber who attacked a women's hospital in Liverpool on Remembrance Sunday had exploited a merry-go-round of asylum appeals, launching a series of legal challenges. The terrorist, Imad Al-Suilmin, 32, had been in the Home Office's system for 7 years and had an outstanding asylum appeal, meaning he could not be deported. He had even converted to Christianity in an apparent attempt to improve his case, although investigators have revealed that he was seen praying at a mosque in the months before his attack. And we should also add some criticism here of the Church of England that were facilitating that, and it does look as if they've been facilitating a lot of these fake asylum seekers and helping them to pretend that they are Christian, and to say that they will be persecuted in their own countries if they get sent back there. And that's not to say that the church is deliberately doing that, but I should imagine that they look at it and they think, well, even if we are suspicious that this guy is actually a Muslim, it's still going to be worse in his country than here. And they're just being taken advantage of. You know, these church ladies, these very charitable people that we have among us, they're being taken advantage of by these out-groups to the detriment of our own in-group. Eventually, permanent accommodation may be found in social housing or the private rental sector provided by local authorities. And of course, every one of them that takes over a house, that means that's one house less for ourselves, and all the new houses that are actually being built are being built for these newcomers, because we do not produce enough as white people in Britain. We do not produce enough offspring to replace ourselves, which means that we are producing less people than we already need for the housing that's already here. So if we didn't have these newcomers, there would be more than enough housing that was already built in the country for our descendants to live in. All of this unnecessary building work on the Greenbelt land and everywhere else, it's all being driven by this massive increase in migration. Claims continue to be processed, but progress is tortuous. Figures published yesterday show that at the end of September, more than 67,500 cases were awaiting an initial decision. About 30,000 cases are more than a year old, and crucially, asylum seekers can apply for the right to work if the Home Office has not made a decision within a year. In all, more than 125,000 claims, equivalent to the populations of Exeter or Solihull, are being processed, including those who have lodged appeals and failed asylum seekers. So even when they get told, well, you're not actually eligible to claim asylum, they're still able to stay here, they're still able to get legal aid, and they choke up the system, as is happening here. And I guess people on the left will be saying, well, this is why we need to have an amnesty for them. We need to have an amnesty, give them all citizenship, and then start again. And this is not just people on the left either. I mean, Boris Johnson has suggested this. I mean, sadly, I think we may see something like that over the next few years, unless there really is some will to put a stop to this. I mean, you never know. Good things might happen. They may build a holding facility for them in somewhere like Africa. It is now being suggested, and that did provide a solution for Australia. But of course, we know how averse our leaders are to common sense ideas. If a case is refused, legal aid-funded lawyers will launch challenges in the immigration courts. This can involve repeated claims lasting for years. Many will hinge on the European Convention on Human Rights, enshrined into law by Labour's 1998 Human Rights Act. In many appeals that are ultimately rejected, the failed asylum seeker still cannot be removed, for example, because their home country is deemed unsafe. Other legal challenges are jaw-dropping. And why are these countries unsafe? Well, the countries are unsafe because the people that are in them are unsafe. And if enough of them move into a safe country, it just means that that area that they are living in is now going to be unsafe as well. I mean, they don't seem to think about this. They just think, well, we want what they have over there. And instead of thinking, well, why is it that they have what they have over there and we don't have it over here? They just think, well, why? I want that. Well, you have to build it. That's the thing. And it's the nationalist-minded people amongst these other groups that are the ones that want to build things in their own countries, but they haven't got the resources to do that because everybody else is leaving. If only they were encouraged to stay where they were, then they could build up their countries. Lady Michelle Renouf's idea, or an idea of a friend of hers, is that when we give out the foreign aid to these countries, it should be with a stipulation. This aid has to be used for building up the country, and you have to prevent people from leaving the country. And then the money would definitely go to good causes, and the people that were living in that country, their lives would be improved, and we wouldn't have to put up with people trying to break into our country. Just as a simple stipulation along with that foreign aid, you have to prevent anybody else coming from your country. And if you don't, you have to accept the people back if they do try to break into our country. Last year, a Zimbabwean gun criminal won the latest skirmish in his 14-year battle to avoid deportation, telling the Supreme Court that back home he'd be unable to access his HIV medication. Despite the fact 86% of HIV-positive Zimbabweans do receive such treatment. And I think that hinged around the actual treatment wouldn't be so good as the treatment that he gets on the NHS. He was permitted to launch yet another appeal. Even clandestine arrivals who get into Britain undetected eventually have legal options. If they manage to remain under the radar for 20 years, they can apply for regularised status and a decade later even win indefinite leave to remain. Is it any wonder that despite the huge risks, tens of thousands are making the perilous journey? Of course it isn't any wonder, and the government know this. The solution to this is so simple, and yet they keep prevaricating, they keep blaming Macron, they keep blaming the French police, when the blame lies squarely on their own shoulders, and they are the only ones that can actually do anything about this. Well, thank you very much for listening. I will be back on Monday with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion. Talk Radio for the nationalist community.